on eyewitnesses, on digital evidence, photographic and video, satellite technology. We particularly have been assisted by the evidence of foreign medical workers who spent time in Gaza. They're not secondary evidence or hearsay evidence. They told us what they actually saw. And it's because of our own investigations that we came to the conclusions that we did. And that's the basis of the last part of your question. Why now? Why now? Because now, after painstakingly collected all of this evidence, now we are able to do what lawyers do. Collect evidence, find facts, apply the law. And this report is our conclusions.
Thank you. Now we'll go to the back and then we'll come back up. Thanks.
Thank you. Moussa Asi, Al Mayadeen TV. My question concerning the term of genocide, you used this term maybe for the first one. If this term will have an impact of the work of International Court of Justice, because the International Court of Justice has not fully used this term till now, and the High Commissioner of Human Rights in Geneva has not used this term till now, if there is an impact of those entities. Thank you.
Thank you for your question. I've been asked already whether, had I been the High Commissioner still, I would have reacted as High Commissioner Volker has, and I probably would have. I also believed you have to wait for a court to determine whether genocide has occurred. That's what I used to tell. I told this team at the beginning that that's why we don't examine genocide immediately. Because, as you know, I was a judge on the panel on the Rwanda tribunal that delivered the world's first judgment on genocide. I know how carefully you have to look for evidence to support that special intention to destroy a group in whole or in part. However, serving on this commission, as we said, we looked at the facts. And that means a two-year work. And the High Commissioner Volker doesn't have the benefit of this report until today. Now, why did I learn that genocide must be addressed? It's because how the Genocide Convention makes imposes an obligation on states to prevent and punish genocide. Now, how will they do that if we all sit and wait for some court, if ever, to determine genocide has occurred? And therefore, we must look at the facts, look at the policy statements made by political leaders. We apply the two. And the most important statement we have so far is the order of the ICJ that there is plausible reason that there's a risk of genocide being committed. So that's the most authoritative statement to states and to all of us to examine this crime.
Okay, thank you. We'll go to the front row and then we'll move back.
Thank you very much, Abdullah Imasi from Al Arabi TV. Thanks for this insightful report and well-documented report. Even the Israelis are not happy with it. As you always, like moments ago, the Israeli ambassador said that this report is full of lie and allegation against Israel. Talking about Israeli officials, in your report, you named Herzog, Netanyahu, and Gallant for incitement. Now, my question is, what action should state take after this report? And my second question is like as a follow-up of my colleague from the EP, what single binding step must government take within 30 days under the Genocide Convention? Thank you very much.
So far as those named as having been responsible for the incitement of genocide, we have made a recommendation to the International Criminal Court that examine the evidence in relation to their statements and consider whether they should be prosecuted. That is a matter for the court. I should add that we have focused on the three of the top officials responsible for this area. But there are many, many statements by Israeli political and civilian leaders that incite genocide, and also by others, including some media commentators in Israel, that have been inciting genocide. So we just looked at the tip of the iceberg, and that is those at the very top of the command pyramid within Israeli society. The incitement to genocide is a separate standalone crime under the Rome Statute. And that's what we're focused on, that crime of incitement in naming them at the top of the pyramid of command. So it's up to the court, but we have provided the evidence in our report and we've made a recommendation to the court, and we will see what action the court takes.
Okay, thank you. The second row, please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Jeremy Lange for the French Public Radio. Kind of a follow-up question to my colleague's previous ones. Another way to ask you for that is, are you hoping that from now on the UN, the Secretary General, the High Commissioner, will use the word genocide and not acts of genocide? And same thing for the state parties. And also, are you calling, it's a yes or no question, are you calling for Israeli state leaders, Benjamin Netanyahu, Yoav Gallant, and Isaac Herzog to be brought before the ICC?
So yes to that second question. You just wanted no or yes. Yes, it is our hope that this report will be read by the higher-ups, including the Secretary General at the United Nations. Because they too are trained to be guided by the facts. This is the first time that, and we are the only investigating body of the UN that has taken 2 years to verify facts. So most of these facts already appear in our reports, but we investigated three or four areas of new facts as well. So the facts should influence high-level leaders at the United Nations also to call this what it is, the genocide.
Yeah, look, just a short addition. Others have commented on genocide before in relation to Gaza. I mean, there have been some excellent NGO reports. And particularly, I would single out the report of Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territory. A strong report, a well-argued report, produced by a different methodology from ours. Our methodology is based, as I said before, on our own investigations and our own conclusions. So I can say that given that this is investigative based, this is likely to be the most authoritative report on the question of genocide in Gaza until the International Court of Justice delivers its decision in 2 or possibly 3 years' time. So pending the decision of the court, this is it. And it's up to the Secretary General and the High Commissioner to make their own decisions, but I would expect that they would start using the word genocide based upon our report after it's released now.
You're listening to Chris Sidoti on Israel's genocide in Gaza, the UN report. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
Thank you. Next, we'll go to Agence France-Presse.
Yes, hi, thank you. Agnès Pedro from AFP. I have two small questions, I hope. The U.S. Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, yesterday called, he talked about barbaric animals, talking about Hamas. So I would be interested to know if you think that this could be considered as well as inciting to genocide, as the, I think the word animals is in the report as well. And then after the publication of this report, I would like also I would be interested to know what would you say as well to the Israeli society, given that their leaders are clearly pointed in the report and the conclusions of the report are quite strong. So what do you say to them, what they should do or what they could do as well? Thank you.
Thank you for the question on inside Israel. You know, to our knowledge, clearly the people inside Israel are not exposed to news as we are, and from all of you. I hope that they get access to this report. Much of our information, I should say, comes from cooperation from people inside Israel, victims, experts, who've shared some of the details with us. And it must affect them to have this kind of report and a recording of the implications of these statements made by their leaders. Now, the Rubio question, I'll leave to Chris.
The Rubio question I'll answer very quickly. I haven't read what he said, and I haven't got the faintest idea what its impact may be. But I do want to join Navi on the second question, because to me, this is one of the most significant issues. I hope that our report will reach through to the people of Israel beyond the majority, not all, but the majority of the Israeli media that consistently wipes out critical information that people are entitled to and that people need. The people of Israel have been betrayed by their government from the beginning. Betrayed on the 7th of October when 1,200 Israeli people were killed. Betrayed by the government in the government's abject refusal to take action to rescue hostages. Betrayed by the Israeli government in pursuing for 2 years now this genocidal war that has made the peace and security and the prosperity of the Israeli people almost impossible for the foreseeable future. The people of Israel are victims in this as much, not as much. There's no comparison with the suffering of the Palestinian people in the last 2 years. But the people of Israel are also the victims of this, victims of the betrayal of their own government. And anything that I can do and we can do that will assist the people of Israel to see what is happening, to take responsibility for their government's actions and act to end it, is only a good, is only a positive. We cannot understand how traumatic the 7th of October was for the people of Israel. And the trauma and their suffering has been ruthlessly manipulated by Netanyahu and his cronies for the last 2 years. And it's time that it stopped. And it's time that those who were responsible for this were held accountable.
Let's take a question from the New York Times.
Yeah, thanks for taking the question. There's a significant gap between plausible evidence of genocide referenced by the ICJ in its provisional order and your conclusion intent to commit genocide was the only reasonable inference that could be drawn. I'm just wondering, there are other possible explanations for some of the incidents that you cite in the report, military units acting on their own, getting carried away, the chaos of war, that it wasn't necessarily a specific plan. Were there specific issues or incidents or acts that helped convince you that you were dealing with intent that was the only reasonable inference? Thank you.
The ICJ will not examine whether genocide has occurred, is occurring, anything until they reach the stage of arguments on the merits. Then they hear both sides. So they had to skirt around that and found plausible grounds that it is happening in order to order the provisional measures. It's too bad that these provisional measures ordered by the ICJ have been violated by Israel.
Again, could I just add a little to what Navi has said, Nick? The position of the ICJ is entirely understandable. I mean, they, as Navi said, they hadn't finished the case, but also they were looking at this 2 years ago. And the best indicator of how strong the ICJ was in what it said has been the hysterical action by the State of Israel and the United States to the ICJ's interim provisional measures based upon the evidence available to it. But I think the ICJ went a long way. That was 2 years ago. Of course, our findings now are different because we've had 2 years to investigate. And we conduct the investigations ourselves. The ICJ is dependent upon evidence being put before it. So we have an advantage in that sense. I'm sorry, the second question again, I got focused on the first.
It was really what allowed you to bridge the gap between plausible evidence and this being the only reasonable inference intent?
Investigation and reporting. We've been criticised for being slow, and I accept that it's taken a long time, but that's a direct product of our methodology. We've produced reports in the last 2 years on what happened in the first 3 months, the saturation bombing campaign, the continuing slaughter, the destruction of the healthcare facilities, the destruction of educational facilities, sex and gender-based violence, destruction of cultural properties, including mosques, churches, archaeological sites, universities, libraries, museums. We've done all that. And it's that investigation and those conclusions that enable us to say that these were genocidal acts, that they were committed intentionally. And what enabled us to make the leap from fact to genocidal purpose were the two things that we have highlighted. First, there is direct evidence in the statements of the Israeli leaders in positions of command responsibility. And second, there is a comprehensive, widespread, in fact, Gaza-wide pattern of operations that lead to no other reasonable inference than this is occurring because of a genocidal purpose. So it's the combination of our own investigations and the breadth of what is happening, the extremity of what is happening. This is no minor matter. The extremity of what is happening is such that we could come to no other reasonable inference than genocidal purpose. But that was in addition to the cold, hard facts of what they said. It comes out of their own mouths.
Thank you. We'll take one question from online. D. Ravi Kanth, please go ahead.
Thank you. To both of you, the question is, there seems to be some kind of a conundrum between the the Genocide Convention of 1948 and the Rome Treaty. Some countries, for example, are signatories to the Genocide Convention, while they are not to the Rome Treaty. Why I'm asking this question is the Indian issue here. India has, doesn't it enjoin on India, for example, to stop all kinds of either defense or commercial dealings with Israel, since it's a member of the Genocide Convention, but not a member of the Rome Treaty. Thank you.
The difference between the Genocide Convention and the Rome Statute, in this case, is simply a difference of process. The Genocide Convention provides a process of the International Court of Justice. The Rome Statute, and it deals with states. The Rome Statute deals with individual accountability, and it provides the process of the International Criminal Court. But the law in relation to genocide, the prohibition of genocide, the obligation to prevent genocide and to punish genocide, these are customary international law provisions that apply to all states, whether they've ratified the Genocide Convention or not, and whether they have ratified the Rome Statute or not. So the difference is one of process. It's not a difference of law. And all countries in the world, whether ratifying one or other or neither, are subject to international law that says that genocide must be prevented, genocide must not be committed, genocide must not be incited, and where it occurs, genocide must be punished. And this is where they have existing obligations. They don't have to wait for the International Court of Justice's decision. In fact, for me, the most significant aspect of the interim orders of 26 January 2024 was that every country in the world was put on notice by the International Court of Justice that there was a plausible risk of genocide in Gaza. And if it had not happened before that, it certainly happened then, that every country in the world became obliged under the law to take action, not to speak fine words, to take action to prevent genocide. There can be no doubt whatsoever that that obligation was activated on the 24th of January 2024, if not before. And in response to your question, that applies as much to India as, Jamie, it applies to Germany and the United States, as it applies to my country and every other country.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we are almost out of time. Do we have time for one more question? Okay. We have one more question online from Anadolo. If you could please go ahead.
I just wanted to have a quick follow-up after Chris's words. You say that member states does not need to follow, does not need to wait the ICJ decision on genocide, but in the report you say that Israel has flagrantly disregarded ICJ orders. And do we think that after ICJ goes with the genocide declaration, do we will have any leverage that the accountability will be changed? And what would be the difference that member states still supporting Israel? This mean that they would be kind of held accountable under third state support? Thank you.
The International Court of Justice gives a clear guidance on what they mean by preventing and punishing genocide. And so clearly it begins with the state's investigation of the incident. And we regularly wrote to the Israeli authorities to ask whether they had investigated this incident or that, or can they give us a response. Now, that would have been very helpful to us, the Commission, to check on what Nick raised, that people may have other motives. Motive, by the way, is irrelevant to the Genocide Convention because that's a peremptory obligation imposed on every state to prevent and punish genocide. There has to be investigations. If they had given us national investigations, we could have checked whether some soldier acted spontaneously or not. Once again, let me say my own experience as a judge on the Rwanda tribunal. We did that, and we found certain acts of rape were not connected. And so we said these are opportunistic violations, sexual violations that occurred because people took advantage of the situation. So that's a process of judging. And with that experience, we did very carefully scrutinize here. But we would have benefited if Israel had conducted national investigations.
Okay, thank you very much, Commissioner Pillay. Thank you, Commissioner Saidoti, and thank you everyone for joining us. That brings us to the end of this press conference.
You were just listening to Nave Pillay on Israel's genocide in Gaza, the UN report. She was preceded by Chris Saidoti and Irene Khan. They spoke at the UN in Geneva in mid-September. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Peter Beinert, Amy Goodman, Chris Hedges, Naomi Klein, Gabor Mate, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Norman Finkelstein. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Nave Pile, Chris Sedoti, and Irene Khan on Israel's genocide in Gaza, the UN report, and for the classic Howard Zinn book, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. George is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Oud virtuoso Haid Manukyan performing Makan Nihaven.
Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
in the home of Burnaby Rock, CJSF's Lux Rock Electronic Show. 2 hours of relative power each and every Friday, 6 to 8 p.m., and repeats every Thursday, 10 to midnight, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Do it.